From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, and in this hour of our summer book week, we take a little trip down the thruway. Somewhere north of Albany, the town of North Bath doesn't appear on any real maps, but it found a place in readers' hearts 2 decades ago when Richard Russo detailed a long Thanksgiving weekend in the life of its inhabitants in his bestseller Nobody's Fool, which then became a hit movie starring Paul Newman. Sully, the construction worker, his boss Carl Roebuck, his loyal assistant Rub, Hattie's Diner, they are all back now in Russo's sequel, Everybody's Fool. Richard Russo joins us now from Portland, Maine. Welcome to our summer book week. Glad you could be with us.
Well, thank you, Scott. Good to be here.
Let me begin by talking about where here is, because, of course, you are an author who has written extensively about places that we kind of recognize here in Rochester. You are originally from Gloversville, and it would not be wrong to see a lot of Gloversville in the Mohawk Valley in your fictional North Bath, right?
No, of course. You know, when my first novel came out, it was called Mohawk, and it wasn't for the actual town of Mohawk, speaking of the Thruway, just off the Thruway, but really for the entire region. And over the years, I have moved my various fictional Gloversvilles kind of up and down the Northway, up and down the Thruway. I even moved one as far away as Maine, Empire Falls. I put in Maine, but it's really just another version of these same upstate New York towns that I've been writing about, you know, for the better part of 30 years now. It's been a long time.
What is it about this region that is so incredibly gripping?
Well, I've wondered that off and on. What brings me back? Sometimes I feel, you know, a little bit like Joyce or Faulkner. I'm not comparing styles or gravitas, but but you know, there's something about Faulkner's fictional Mississippi county that keeps pulling him back there, and of course Joyce had to leave Dublin, physically leave it in order to write about it, but there was never any place else that he called home. And I feel much the same way about my upstate New York mill towns, and I think it just has to do with the fact that when you're young and you're seeing the world for the first time, you look at it differently. The world is new, and it's bright, and it's mysterious, and you don't know things, and your sense of wonder is engaged as a kid. And everything hasn't happened 27 times yet. You don't have the feeling of the world as a mundane place where the same things happen over and over again. And you're just everything is imprinted on your memory. Every experience is imprinted in a different way. Past, you know, you get past 20 years old or so, you begin to notice the repetition. Something does begin to happen. The same things begin to happen over and over again. And at that point, I think you're just really fiddling with your software. Whereas those experiences that you have as a younger person, and I lived in Gloversville for the first 18 years of my life, and even when I went off to the University of Arizona for college, and I was there for the better part of a decade, kind of a slow learner. But even during most of those years, I was returning home to Gloversville to work road construction with my father. So, you know, the really formative years, when the world was new to me as a kid, and then as a young adult, and finally as a 20-year-old, 21-year-old, most of that was spent in Gloversville, New York.
And then you get the realization, especially if you go somewhere as far off as Arizona, that not everywhere in the world looks like the place that you grew up, and that there are things, you know, the old broken down homes that nobody's lived in for 40 years, and the mill on the edge of town. Not every place looks like that or feels like that.
No, it doesn't. You know, actually Arizona, going to Arizona was a kind of shock to me because, you know, the physical landscape, of course, of the desert is so different, but the geography is different, and you I always got a sense in living in Arizona that everything there was new, you know, and there was very little sense of history, at least not in the sense of, you know, colonial upstate New York and New England. And I always got the sense in whenever I walked into a building that it was built yesterday, and for buildings that weren't built yesterday, it always seemed to me like they were about to fall down. And so, you know, going to places like Gloversville in the Mohawk Valley, you come back to them and you see those grand old mills that have been abandoned, and, you know, depending on where you are, in some cases being retrofitted to serve other purposes. You do have that sense of the nation's history. And to me, that's been very important because in some ways the Mohawk Valley that I write about is every bit as much the Mohawk Valley of my parents and my grandparents, and to some extent even more than it is my own.
Which brings us to the new novel, Everybody's Fool, and you've never done a sequel before. From what I understand, you never really intended to do a sequel, and then this story popped up about a garage door opener.
Yeah, and that's not even an upstate New York story, and I have no idea whether the story is true or not. But along the coast of Maine, where I was living at the time, my wife and I live in Portland now, but at the time we were living in Camden, Maine, a small coastal village. And there was a story going around, I have no idea whether it was true or not, that in one of those coastal villages in Maine, there was a cop who was suspicious that his wife might be stepping out on him, and his suspicions really cranked up when he discovered in her car a garage door remote that did not open their garage, which set him wondering what garage around town or in the neighboring towns it might open. And he actually took the garage door opener and kind of went neighborhood to neighborhood, trying to find out which garage door it would open, because then his logic was that if he could find the garage door that it actually opened, that he would then know who his wife's lover was. And he had no idea, of course, that it doesn't work that way, that one garage door opener theoretically could open more than one garage door in any given community. But that was the idea he was working on. And when I heard that story, number one, I always collect stories of, you know, kind of human lunacy, people acting not at their smartest. And immediately when I heard this story, I just kind of stored it away. I generally don't write things down, but I stored it away in the back of my brain as something that I would probably be able to use one day. And I thought, even at the time, I thought, who in the world would do something like that? And it just reminded me of Officer Raymer, you know, 23 years earlier in Nobody's Fool, he was Sully's nemesis. And so I got to thinking about Raymer and what would have happened to him in the meantime. And, you know, my first thought was, well, he was such an awful cop, he probably would have been fired. He's probably doing something else now. And then I had a second thought, which was, no, of course, that's not the way things work. He would have failed upwards. He would now be the chief of police, and he would be in exactly the same position as this local cop who I heard the story about.
And in this book, you know, Raymer was a fairly tangential character. He appeared in a couple of scenes in Nobody's Fool, the book, and of course in Nobody's Fool, the movie. He was played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, our own hometown Rochester, New York actor. And then all of a sudden, Everybody's Fool, you realize, I'm not reading a book about Sully exactly.
Right.
I'm reading a book that's much more about Chief Raymer.
And I think that that's one of the reasons that the book works, actually, is that I don't think I would have gone back there and told the story if Sully and Rub and Carl Roebuck weren't going to be part of it. And even Miss Burl, who's been dead 10 years before the story of this book begins, even she is an important character in the novel, because she lives so vibrantly, so vividly in the imaginations of most of the characters. So I wouldn't have wanted to go back to this place without revisiting these people. But the thing about, you know, for me anyway, the least attractive thing about a sequel is going back to the same main character. You know, Updike did it, of course, with the Rabbit books, and Richard Ford has done it with his Frank Bascom novels. But I was much more attracted to what Larry McMurtry has done in several of his books that were based on the original characters of Lonesome Dove. We had Gus McCrae and Woodrow Call, and that magnificent first book. But then there were other sequels and prequels, and sometimes it was one of the other Rangers who stepped forward and became the main character. So you got to visit with old friends, but you know, you discovered that some minor character has this unsuspected, wonderfully vivid interior life. And that fits in rather neatly with my own personal philosophy, which is, you know, not only of art, but of life. And that is that there are no small lives. And if you look at people closely enough, and it matters enough to you to figure out what's going on inside them, they all become wonderfully multifaceted and fascinating. And I really didn't, you know, as soon as I wrote the first scene in this new book with Chief Raymer as the main character, there was just no doubt in my mind that this would be a book more about him than about Sully. And of course, it didn't hurt at all to be seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman standing there in front of me in my imagination as I began to write about this guy.
So this was before we lost Hoffman?
Oh, I had been working on this book for probably, you know, a couple of years, I would say. I was maybe 250, 300 pages into it, because I actually interrupted this book to write a memoir called Elsewhere, and then I went back to it after that. So, but I was still a couple hundred, maybe 300 pages into this when we got the terrible news about Philip's death. And I remember, I mean, in addition to being so filled with sadness for, you know, not just a wonderful actor's loss, but a truly wonderful human being too. I mean, the loss hit us all in the industry, I think, pretty hard. But in addition to that, I thought to myself, well, all right, I've been thinking about every time Raymer has said something or done something, I've been seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman in my mind's eye, and I guess I'm just going to have to let that go. But of course, I was never able to. And once I kind of reconciled myself to that fact, I just allowed Philip to, and his memories, both not only his memory as Raymer in the earlier novel, but memory of working with him in Empire Falls for the HBO miniseries where he played Charlie Mayne, and following all of his movies since then. I just decided that the smart thing and actually the more humane thing to do in all of this is, rather than trying to put him out of my mind because he was gone, was to just let him reside there as part of my imagination, as a kind of welcome ghost in a book about ghosts, because everybody in this novel is haunted.
Indeed. We are talking with Richard Russo, the Pulitzer Prize winning author of Empire Falls and Nobody's Fool, and now Everybody's Fool, the sequel. He is on the line with us from Portland, Maine, on Connections on Summer Book Week. This is, you talk about the book being haunted with ghosts. It is overall a much darker book. Nobody's Fool, you like these people. You wanted to find yourself on a lazy afternoon in North Bath, stopping in and having a bite to eat with them. You've got characters in Everybody's Fool who you really don't want to cross in this case, who have very little that is redeeming about them. And in particular, this character who is returning to town with a really vicious streak in him. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you're right. It's a much darker book, and people in it like Roy Purdy, the woman batterer, and Kurt, who has a large backstory that explains why the poor mayor's wife is the way she is, and Spinmatic's Joe, the incredible racist. And right in the middle of all of it, there's this traveling salesman who deals in exotic poisonous reptiles, and the snakes which turn up in various parts of the movie are of course intended to suggest the Garden of Eden and the existence of evil in our world. And when I sat down to write this book, it wasn't that I thought, all right, this book should be a darker book, or this book should have snakes in it, or that there should be a character in it whose principal pleasure in life is beating up on women. None of those things occurred to me at all, but in the 23 years since I wrote Nobody's Fool, I think the world has just become a darker place in so many ways. And the reason that this book is so much darker is that we as a nation have suffered through a lot. We've suffered through 9/11 and the rise of ISIS and a kind of now, I think, a kind of terrifying nationalism that we're seeing not only in the United States but across the world. We're living in much less hopeful times, I think, and the darkness in Everybody's Fool is just, I think, an acknowledgement of everything that's happened in the 23 years since that book was published, and the darker place that not only I as an author but an awful lot of authors are living in right now.
I was struck especially in reading both books in quick succession at the difference in the way that race is handled between them. And Nobody's Fool, there's one black character who is a cook at the diner, and you see him briefly, and there are a couple of cracks in there about how, you know, he's the only black guy in town, and then he disappears for a while. In Everybody's Fool, it's a much more real presence. You've got the chief's assistant and then her brother, who are both black. Talk to me a little bit about the different ways that race plays in here now.
And Mr. Hines.
Yes.
And Mr. Hines as well, the elderly black man who sits out at the curb in front of his apartment house waving an American flag. Race is much more prevalent in this book. It's a subject in this book. And it's a subject that I've always been interested in. For some writers, I think class is kind of in America, class can be seen as a subset of race because poverty in America so often has a black face. But I think it's also possible to see race as a subset of class, just reversing the order and seeing that class that our various that our class system in this country, which is much more pronounced than most Americans are willing to admit, is and can be a kind of destiny into itself. And then when you add race as a factor into that, you begin to see race as destiny as well. And in the mostly lily-white towns of my first three novels, up to and including Nobody's Fool, I was content to, I think, just kind of go with the demographics of so many of these upper New York State mill towns, which are pretty white. But I began to be dissatisfied with that along about the time I was writing Empire Falls. And by the time Bridge of Sighs came along, probably my most ambitious novel, you suddenly saw these towns have a much more significant black presence. There were far more black characters. And in this book, I had it was a challenge, but it was also a joy to turn that card face up, and it was more joyous than I anticipated that it was going to be, because of those two main black characters, Charisse and Jerome. Charisse, who Raymer would like to think might be in love with him, but he certainly wouldn't leap to that conclusion. Charisse just has more fun tormenting Raymer and his inability to deal with race, his inability to come to terms with the fact that there's this attractive black woman who might or might not be attracted to him. And of course, Jerome, her tall, handsome, very well educated black brother, has similar fun with Raymer. Their last name is Bond, and he plays against stereotype by taking on the characteristics of that other famous Bond. And we see him the first time he pulls up, he's in his Mustang convertible, and he says, "The name is Bond, Jerome Bond." And it was really a joy to visit race in ways that were both comic and serious. And later on, in one of the darker scenes in the novel, Sully has to come to terms with this drunk at the bar. His name is Joe, and everybody calls him Spinmatics Joe because he's always railing against the Spinmatics, and it takes people a while to discover that what he's really talking about is Hispanics, but he can't wrap his tongue around the words. So this was an opportunity for me, I don't know, perhaps belatedly, to add race, a subject that I've long been interested in America, at a time when race is much more on our national national radar. And to be able to do that especially in a sequel where we realize that, you know, what happened to this lily white town? Well, it's not so lily white anymore, and good, you know. That was a challenge, but it was also a lot of fun.
Is it fraught in 2016 as a white guy who's from the Mohawk Valley to be writing these scenes? Do you worry about the authenticity of them, being able to inhabit these characters accurately?
Well, everything about storytelling is fraught, Scott. When you come right down to it, I think the short answer to your question is yes, of course. Of course it's fraught. These subjects that matter the most to us are always fraught. And the fraught subjects are the ones that we spend so much time in terms of self-doubt in our own lives, questions of gender and sexuality and race and class. These are the things that make us nervous, but that doesn't mean we stay away from them. You try to approach these subjects with a kind of humility. And they're fraught. I mean, I felt the same way the first time. At one point, fairly, or probably around the time of Nobody's Fool, I had written a series of books about fathers and sons and their relationships. But shortly after that, I looked in my own life and saw that all the most important people in my life were women. My wife, my two daughters, my mother was still alive at that point. And I began to see that my novels had to be much more fully peopled with complex women. Well, that was terrifying to me because, you know, what writer wants reviewers to say, well, one thing is clear, Richard Russo doesn't know a damn thing about women. writers don't like to be told that they don't know enough enough to tell stories. And the same thing is true about race. The same thing is true about violence. But they are the subjects, you know. Since Huckleberry Finn, these are the important subjects in American literature. And you just kind of have to steel yourself with resolve and try not to pretend to be an expert on anything, but just address the subjects that are most important to you as a writer, but also to the nation.
Richard Russo is with us from Portland, Maine, where he now lives. He is the author of Nobody's Fool and the new Everybody's Fool. We will continue our conversation with him on Connections Summer Book Week right after this quick break. On Friday's Connections, what are your kids reading this summer? Our Summer Book Week wraps up with 2 hours on children's and young adult books. Join Megan Mack for a panel discussion in Hour 1. Then in Hour 2, I'll talk with local YA authors Charles Benoit and Linda Sue Park. Scott Feibusch here in for Evan Dawson. Join us for Connections Friday at noon and again at 9 on AM 1370 and FM 88.5. And we are back on Connections Summer Book Week. I'm Scott Feibusch, and we are talking with Richard Russo, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Empire Falls and Mohawk and Nobody's Fool and now Everybody's Fool. I want to get back to Nobody's Fool for a minute. We had talked earlier about Philip Seymour Hoffman and about what was actually a fairly small role that he played there, although he'd later go on to work with him in Empire Falls on HBO as well. There are a lot of actors now from Nobody's Fool, including Paul Newman and including actually a fair amount of the cast, Jessica Tandy, who played Miss Burrell.
Yeah.
What's it like at this point as you write that? You know, you said that you had Philip Seymour Hoffman in your head as you were writing the character of Raymer. Can you write Sully now without seeing Paul Newman?
No, it's impossible. And it's kind of funny, too, because I remember the feeling that I had when I got a call from the producer of Nobody's Fool saying that they had just signed Paul Newman in the role. And I remember thinking, geez, really? My Sully is that good looking? you got to be kidding me. If I had cast an actor at that time, based on his looks and based on the way I had described Sully physically in the novel, I probably would have cast somebody like Roy Scheider, you know, this kind of scrap iron guy who looks like he's done hard work all of his life. Certainly not anybody who was with Paul Newman's great good looks, but that's what actors do. That's what the great ones do. And of course, Paul Newman spent his whole career trying to play down his good looks instead of trading on them. And his great roles were roles like Sully and the wonderful character, the drunken lawyer in The Verdict. And he always played kind of fallen men or men with crosses to bear in some way. That was what he did best. In other words, what he was going after was not the character's outer appearance, but what was going on inside him. And I remember the first time I went to the set and saw some of the what they call the rushes, the dailies these are just scenes that you're seeing one version of the scene shot after another, and remember seeing Paul deliver some of my lines in that and thinking, well, this is the guy. This is my Sully. And the first time I saw him on the set was even before I'd seen any of the rushes. He was coming out of his trailer, and I had just arrived in town with my family, and he came walking towards me, and he was limping. And this was only like 3 or 4 days into the shoot. And I thought, oh my God, you know, he's 70 years old playing a 60-year-old, and we're only 3 days into the set and he's already hurt. How is this going to work? But of course, he wasn't hurt at all. He was Sully, and it was Sully who had fallen off a ladder and shattered his knee, and Paul was limping because his character was limping, and his knee hurt because his character's knee hurt, and it was like that during the entire shoot. And so Paul owns at least half of that character now. when Nobody's Fool was published, Sully was mine. I could lay claim and ownership to that character. But writing Everybody's Fool, I had to constantly say not only what would Sully do, but what would Paul do? What would Paul do with this? What would Paul do with this line? And we worked on three movies together. We worked on Nobody's Fool and Empire Falls and a detective movie called Twilight. And so it's not like we were ever intimate friends, but I got to know the man and began to see him as some of these characters. And it's just, you know, he's part owner now. Of these men that he helped create. And I think just as significantly, maybe even more so, I mean, the reason that people are interested in a sequel 23 years after the fact is pretty remarkable. And I think the reason that they're still interested, you know, has an awful lot to do with the wonderful new movie that Robert Benton made of Nobody's Fool and that astonishing performance that Paul Newman gave in it. That's the reason that there was so much interest after all this time.
And Jessica Tandy too. You can't downplay her role.
No, and she was another character who another actor who, when she was cast, that it ran counter, almost completely counter to the physical description that I had given in the book. In the book, Miss Burrell is a very short woman, and she's a virtual humpback. She suffers arthritis, and she's completely bent over and so gnarled in her appearance that her eighth graders cannot imagine that she is married, and they call her Miss Burrell instead of Mrs. Peoples. And when Jessica Tandy was cast, I thought, my God, they found the most upright patrician actor in her 80s in all of Hollywood. But there again, all you had to do is see her on screen for about 30 seconds to know that she knew Miss Burrell every bit as well as I did, and she knew exactly what to do with that character.
And then there were some characters in the movie who, you know, were just perfectly. I'm thinking of Robin, of that performance that was Pro Taylor Vince who played Rob. You know, it was spot on to your description, I thought.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had I've seen Pruitt a couple of times since the movie of Nobody's Fool, and this was his first major film where he had a really significant role, and we've seen him a lot on television since then, but I think I've often wanted to see him more because I think he really is a terrific actor, and he was so good in Nobody's Fool that I had people for years coming up to me and saying. About the character of Rub. They said, who was that in the movie that was playing Rub? Was he an actor, or did they just find somebody who was? And then they would kind of hem and haw and say, find somebody who was, you know, like that.
A little slow on the uptake.
Yeah.
let's talk a little about this character, because he does play a fairly significant role in Everybody's Fool. And, you know, if there's somebody who you kind of find yourself rooting for through the whole thread of the book, it's Rob, who is, you know, somebody that most writers would never give a second thought to. He's, you know, he hitches on to whatever work he can find. He lives on the outskirts of town with, you know, in this apartment that costs him probably, what, $300 a month maybe,
yeah,
to live in?
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
he's kind of a sad sack, and yet you find yourself rooting for him at the end.
Absolutely, I hope you do. Anyway, yeah, I think he's a wonderful character. I think innocence is difficult to do, and I think Rub is, if you had to kind of isolate one thing about him that is just so attractive, is he's just. And innocent. I mean, he may be middle-aged, certainly middle-aged by the time we get to Everybody's Fool. But life hasn't just destroyed him. I mean, he's capable of kind of unambiguous love. He doesn't have an ironic bone in his body. And his devotion to Sully is really painful because another man, a less innocent man, would understand that what he needs from Sully, which is really everything, everything, every moment of every day is what he needs from Sully. And I think Rubs, even his sexuality is a little bit in doubt in both books, because his devotion to Sully, I don't think he's gay kind of in the traditional sense, but I think he is in love with Sully, which is why he can't bear not to be around him. And when Sully good-naturedly ribs him, it just wounds him so deeply, so profoundly. And I think he's just a fascinating human being, and I enjoyed being in his uncluttered mind. I enjoyed that a lot. It felt when you're in Rub's consciousness, when you're writing about Rub, you get to kind of shed everything that you don't like about yourself.
Was it refreshing to get to write Rub after writing some of these incredibly nasty scenes involving Roy and the women's
Yes,
life?
Yes, indeed. You know, writing Roy Purdy, even in revision, even when I knew what the scenes were about and I knew what was going to happen in them and I knew how violent they were and how disturbing they were, even in the editing process, when I was just going through and attending to the sentences and making them as clear and elegant as I could, even then I would finish with one of those Roy Purdy chapters and felt like I needed to go shower, because, you know, this guy sprung from my imagination, from some place in me, and it was that in itself was awful to contemplate. But then you would find Rub, you'd write a Rub chapter with his completely innocent devotion to Sully, and that was the shower I needed right there. Was to just be in this uncomplicated, loving man's mind, without, you know, a man who has no ironic distance, a man who has no ability to offer snarky observations about anybody. And writing Rub was a lot like being able to turn off all of those features of my own mind. Some of the thoughts that I'm least proud of. I never had to worry about entering into Rub.
Although Rub at least does realize that he's being played a little bit when Sully names his dog Rub.
Yes. Oh, of course.
Now, I want to ask about those names, because this is something we're talking with Richard Russo on Summer Book Week on Connections. I want to ask about some of the names. We finally find out, I love the name Rub Squeers, and we finally find out that he's called Rub because he couldn't even pronounce his own name, Robert.
Right, right.
When he was growing up. Where do some of these great names come from? Are these people that you've encountered over the years?
No, but one of the few things that I make notes of in between novels is if I run across an interesting name, I will write it down. Dickens used to do that. And Dickens was, of course, one of the great namers in the history of literature. My names are not quite as comic as Dickens were, but if I do find a name that strikes me, I will write it down. And very often they're one syllable names. In Empire Falls, I was always asked why Miles's daughter, this beautiful, beautiful teenage girl, why I would name her Tick, you know, a blood sucking insect. Why would I do such a thing? And I don't always know why I select the names that I do. But the simpler they are, the fewer syllables they have, the more likely they are to stick in the mind. And I particularly loved in this book having two Rubs, because the dog Rub, I think, is a character. I like to think that the dog Rub is as significant a character, despite being a canine. I think he's a really important character in the book, and it's important that he have the same name that Rub Squeers does, because they share a kind of optimism. Life has been incredibly cruel to both Rubs, And yet they look at the future and they see better days ahead. Their optimism is a triumph over experience. I love them both for it. And when I saw the jacket cover for this book, for Everybody's Fool, and saw that dog in the window of the pickup kind of looking off into the distance, and you can kind of imagine something coming toward him, and he just has this dog has the most optimistic look on his face, like he just cannot wait for the future to get there. This despite the fact that the past has been so cruel to him. And you know some creatures, human, canine, whatever, you know, some people just manage that somehow.
Everything is looking up, right?
Yeah.
One of my favorite names from Nobody's Fool, unfortunately, was a character that we didn't get to see in Everybody's Fool. I was kind of disappointed about this. We never find out what became of Whacker, who is one of Sully's grandsons, and who gets his name because he runs around hitting everything and everyone.
Yeah.
What happened to Whacker?
Oh, if I knew, I would tell you. In this book, I've already told you so much more than I know. and Whacker, I would love to know what's become of Whacker. And I thought long and hard if there was any way to get Whacker into this book, to bring him on stage for a cameo. And you're no more disappointed than I. I just finally gave up because one of my favorite scenes in all of my novels is the scene where Whacker drops the toilet seat on his older brother when he's peeing over the edge into the urinal. I don't know where exactly. I do know exactly where that scene came from, but it's one of my favorite comic set pieces in any of my novels, and of course Whacker is absolutely essential to it, and I would have loved to have gotten him in this book. I think he's probably not turned out well though.
His brother, on the other hand, you talk about people looking ahead to the future, and the other grandson, Will, ends up doing okay for himself, although you kind of suspect, even though he's doing okay for himself, that it's not something that's going to benefit North Bath because he's not sticking around.
No. He'll become part of the diaspora, I think, from that we see so often in upstate New York mill towns. Towns and cities don't offer opportunities, people go elsewhere. And find opportunities where they may. And one of the things that has astonished me over what's turned out to be a much longer career than I would have dared to hope for is that when I am on book tour, it doesn't matter where I am on this book tour. I was all over the East Coast, of course, and still have a little bit more work to do there. But I was in the Midwest. I was in Oxford, Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi. I was on the West Coast. I've been all over the United States, and it is very rare at the end of an evening, if I have a hundred people or a couple hundred people in the audience, someone will raise a hand during the question and answer period and say, "Well, I'm from Gloversville." And it surprised me for a long time, but you know, people have to go somewhere. And I remember one time in Arizona, some friends and I had gone fishing up into the White Mountains, and we drove really deep into the White Mountains. And there were just a couple of cabins up there that we went and run. We went rented one, and some other people had rented another one. And when we pulled up, they called out a welcome. And I just heard it. I said, "Whoa, where are you from?" And he said, "Well, you wouldn't know the place. It's a small town in upstate New York." And I said, "Try me." and he said, "Gloversville." Now this is, we're like 8,000 feet up in the White Mountains in Arizona, and there's And there's another a guy about my age. We're all over the place.
We're talking with Richard Russo, the author most recently of Everybody's Fool. One of the dichotomies that you've been playing up, both in Nobody's Fool and again in Everybody's Fool, is this downtrodden town, and then pretty much right next door, it's Schuyler Springs in the book. In real life, obviously, it's Saratoga. You put them a little closer together than the real life Gloversville and Saratoga are. What's the magic there? Why is it that nothing ever quite works in the real life North Baths or Gloversville? And yet you have these spots up here, you know, maybe it's Canandaigua or these days even Watkins Glen a little bit. What is it that's making some of these places work?
Well, I mean, natural beauty has something to do with it, but, you know, not an awful lot, because the Adirondacks are just beautiful almost everywhere. But some places are more economically viable than others. And in Schuyler Springs, a lot of what's happened in Schuyler Springs, of course, is I've just borrowed from Saratoga. You know, the one set of springs ran dry, and the others are still percolating along. But I've always been fascinated by these kinds of geographic anomalies. Anyway, it's not at all unusual to find a place. You know, that may only be separated by a bridge. You have a town on one side of a river, and you have a bridge going to the other side of the river, and maybe they're in the same state, and you cross and you cross that bridge, and you're crossing the bridge from poverty into a very well-to-do community, and you cannot, and it's to me, when something happens, when two locations are that close together, and they're that similar, and one is poor and the other is rich, one is well off and the other is suffering, and they're connected by a bridge, to me that's like studying twins. You know, twins that maybe have been separated or maybe not separated, and one turns out well and the other doesn't, and yet they have the same genes. How is that possible? But you see it again and again, and not only in America. You see it everywhere, and sometimes it seems to me that it has an awful lot to do with visionary leadership. At some point, somebody has done something right. And it seems to me often that they've made a good decision, but the good decision that they've made is not a good decision about themselves and their own prosperity. They have a sense of a common good, of a common cause, of the fact that maybe in the end we're all in this together. And so they've made the kinds of decisions that they themselves maybe haven't prospered, but the entire community has. And I think we see that again and again. And you know, once you get a history of prosperity, and once you have a history of poverty and a history of failure, those begin to become self-fulfilling prophecies. It's kind of like the, you know, we've all seen these buildings that have like four or five or six different restaurants in them over the years, and they just seem snake bit. No matter what goes in there.
Although I want to ask quickly then, because I actually had some reasons to be in Gloversville about a year ago. And one of the things that you notice driving into the real life Gloversville that is conspicuously absent from North Bath is this magnificent library, this Carnegie Library that sits right in the middle of town that is just stunning.
And it's a great, great story, too. I'm so glad you asked about that, because I was asked to be the honorary chairman for the fundraising drive, and so I've been in Gloversville a lot more in the last couple of years than I had in many years before that, and it's been a thrill. And I say this because I was really kind of a figurehead for the campaign. I came back a few times and lent my voice when I could. But I think everybody involved knew that we were asking people to climb Mount Everest without Sherpas, you know. And when they announced that they really needed about $7 million to save this building, I thought, well, I don't think there's $7 million in the whole Mohawk Valley. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a good cause, and the best causes are all lost causes. So I said, fine, sure, I'll help if I can. But through some just incredible hard work at the local level, an absolutely marvelous fundraiser, some very savvy appeals for grants to the first important one was the Lucius Latour Foundation, and then some changes of historic designation. That incredibly poor community in Fulton County has raised almost all of the money.
It really is.
They're very close to the $7 million that they need, and they're going to get there.
And I'm guessing in North Bath that probably wouldn't happen if they even have a library at all, right?
I think probably not.
One question I did want to ask before we get to the end of the hour, which is approaching. Did you know when you started writing Nobody's Fool that there was a real Bath and a real Schuyler County out here in Western New York?
I think I had it in the back of my mind, which is probably why I called it North Bath.
So there's a little explanation in there at the beginning.
Yeah, it was it's like the real Mohawk down the thruway. I knew there was a real Mohawk, and I knew it was going to cause me some headaches with people going to the wrong place looking for what I'd written, but there you are.
Richard Russo is joining us in our final minute or so here. I want to just talk to you about time, because Nobody's Fool was written about a decade after the events it describes in the 80s. Now you're writing something that's, again, maybe a decade and a half, you know, certainly pre-9/11 in any event.
Yes,
definitely. What were your thoughts in picking that time period?
Well, I wanted to go back to Bath one more time before technology had taken over and made it look more like the rest of America. So we're catching Bath here just at the advent of cell phones and personal computers. And I really wanted to check in on these people when they weren't completely digitally distracted like the rest of us in America are today.
Indeed. Richard Russo, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Author of Everybody's Fool, Nobody's Fool, and Empire Falls. Our thanks to Bill Ryle at Binney Media in Portland to help make this possible. Our producers at this end, Kat Schwartz and Megan Mack. And thank you also to Mike Black for helping out on this end. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Thank you so much for being with us here on Connections from WXXI.